radio.com. My very special guest, Ben Vinton, will be joining us in a moment as soon as he's logged on to his Skype. But in the meantime, I kind of was doing a little bit of a, shall we say, I think I was looking into this, you know, how there's a big movement out there saying, it's the Jews who are behind it all. And I was just watching a debate about it. And have you ever noticed that every kind of crazy ridiculed or, you know, oh, you shouldn't talk to these people kind of guys always actually have something to say properly? You know what I'm saying? It's a little bit odd, but I think that it is pretty much the odd thing to do, to reject things out hand without doing any investigation into them or any of the elements in the equation. It can be pretty bad. Now, I'm also struggling here because I've got to produce while I'm on air. Oh, no. We've got a message from Ben saying he needs to be connected via cell phone now. I'm just going to put that number in for the studio. Hopefully they'll be able to connect him on that phone. If not, I don't know what I'm going to do for this hour. I might actually have to revert back to my other guest, Mr. Morgan. So yeah, bit of a frustrating thing here. It's nice when people turn up on time with the right technology, and if they don't, then they basically put me on the spot and I'm screwed, you know, and just kind of sit around here dithering on air, and it's not nice. It's really not nice. So yeah, it's a little bit of a frustrating one here, and we're just going to be dithering around for several minutes while Ben gets his stuff together, if he can get his stuff together, that is. But yeah, I don't know if we're actually able to get him on at all. We've got his cell phone number, but I'm not sure if the network can even do it. And we're just hearing now from Ben that his Skype's blocked him for 24 hours. So yeah, we're not going to be able to have him on that, and I'd like just the studio, if we can connect Ben at all via cell phone, that'd be nice. Although his cell phone's a pretty bad quality. Last time I tried it, I could barely hear anything from him. So we'll get Mr. Morgan back if we can. We'll have to ditch Ben for another day. Sorry, man. Can't be done.
Hello.
Yep. Okay. Mr. Morgan, welcome to the show.
Yes. Hello, Vinny. Yeah. Good to hear from you.
It is indeed. John Morgan, ladies and gentlemen. Some of you may know who he is, but for those of you who don't, he is an author, a prolific author of some very thick books about the Princess Diana assassination, and I've just received word not a couple of days ago that he's now experiencing a rather life-threatening illness and won't be with us for too much longer. John, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me on, Vinny.
You're very, very welcome. So now that you're in this kind of situation with your health failing, coming to the end of your life, how is your perspective on things, and how does your work relate to this at all?
Yeah, well, I've spent 10 years working on the case of Princess Diana, and I basically got to the end of my investigation, and only just in about 8 months ago, I published my final book on it, which was how. Oh, hang on. Sorry. Hello, I'm on an interview. Can you call back in about half an hour? But okay, bye. Sorry about that.
No worries, continue.
So I published my last book on it, How They Murdered Princess Diana, which was an abridgment of this. I'd written six volumes as a series on various aspects of the case, and that book was an abridgment, so it was really a sort of conclusion to my investigation. So I was really pleased that I was able to finish that, because I've had this illness now since 2002, and it's called multiple system atrophy. It's a neurological illness which causes autonomic breakdown of all of normal functions in the body, and so I've had a deterioration in that. The symptoms have gotten a lot worse in the last two or three weeks, and so that's why I made that press release. But I'll probably only be around for a few months, and I'm just so pleased that I was able to complete the work on that. And I was lucky about it because, I'm sorry.
Oh, for F's sake. maybe yank the cable out, bro, because that's really annoying. All right.
Sorry about that. The phone's hardly rung all morning.
Well, when it rains, it pours.
Sorry, I missed that. I had to take my hearing aid out for the phone call. Sorry. Yeah, I'm back.
Well, when it rains, it pours, doesn't it?
Yes. Okay, so basically the investigation is complete, and I can sort of this illness was always life threatening. It was always going to finish me, and the prognosis was 6 to 10 years, and I've gone for 12 years, or 12 years since I was actually diagnosed. And so but actually what happened was, after I got the illness, I had to retire, and that is when I came up with the need to do something, and it turned out I was able to write the books. So had I not got the illness, then I would never have been able to do the investigation into the death of Princess Diana. So it's sort of pluses and minuses, because it's enabled me to do that. I think it's had an impact on the evidence that's available for the public, and the feedback I get from people is that it's had a huge impact on their understanding of what happened, and so it's great. It's great that I'm able to sort of complete that, and before the illness had gone too far, I was unable to do any more. So in a way, I'm relieved.
Well, it seems to me that there's a compulsion, like people who get illnesses that I've known who have a motivation. That motivation seems to, I don't know, subdue the illness for a period of time until that motivation disappears. And then the illness returns with a vengeance.
Yeah, that can happen. That's right. And that may well be the case, because I was working on that investigation, I was focused on it for the whole 10 years, really, and it sort of consumed me, and it takes your mind off what's going on with the illness. And so even though the symptoms kept on getting worse and progressing, I still managed to work out ways of continuing with the investigation, you know. So And then when I reached that point and got that book published, there has been quite a deterioration since then. But I sort of, you know, you also reach a point where you're absolutely worn out and exhausted. So, you know, people might say, well, why couldn't you just carry on and do another book? But you sort of, I'd sort of reached a point where I was pretty much stuffed, you know. So you sort of, in the end it gets you, I suppose.
Well,
unless you're lucky.
Death and taxes, and I've given rise to the belief that it's the taxes that are killing you.
Yeah, cause that's right, they're killing everyone. Yeah,
just in a general kind of way.
if one thing doesn't get you, something else will.
yeah. Well, nobody gets out alive. That's the.
As far as I know, everyone's died so far. That's right.
Yeah. What was it on Fight Club? On a long enough timeline, the survival rate for everybody drops to zero.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Not too many people live past 120.
Well, let's look on your life then. Let's have a look at your achievements, and in particular the Diana investigation. Can you give people a bit of a background? Just how many books are there, first of all? And secondly, would you be able to give us a reasonably encapsulated blow-by-blow, and I know that's asking a lot, of the night that Diana died, and then we'll see if we can fill in some of the context afterwards.
Okay, yeah, well, the books the series is called Diana Inquest, and there's six volumes in that, and then there was also a book called Diana Inquest, The Documents the Jury Never Saw, and that was as a result of a huge batch of documents that was sent to me from within the British police investigation, and that was in 2010. So I immediately set about publishing them, and that was the result of that book. And so they were very critical documents that formed part of the investigation that was suppressed and withheld from the jury and also from the public. Excuse me. And so there was that book. And then I wrote a summary book, which was a short 200-page book that went through the events. And that was called Paris-London Connection, The Assassination of Princess Diana. And that was published in 2012. And then this latest book, which is quite a large book, it's 800 pages, How They Murdered Princess Diana, The Shocking Truth. And that book is really probably my best book, I feel. I feel it's the most important book I've written, because the summary book sort of showed the story, but this book shows the story, but it also reveals the evidence it's based on. So it's basically the proof of what occurred all in one volume. So, and it's a abridgment of the six volumes, so it's it was a very difficult book to get that together and work out what should go and what shouldn't, but in the end I'm quite content with what's been achieved. So with the story of what happened on the night, is that what you said? Events that occurred, well, the story of Diana's death revolves around the journey from the Ritz Hotel, when the Mercedes left the Ritz Hotel with Diana and Dodie and the driver Henry Paul and the bodyguard Trevor Rees-Jones left the Ritz Hotel at 12:23 a.m. on the 31st of August 1997, and the journey was to go to Dodie Foyer's apartment, where Diana and Dodie were going to be spending the rest of the night. And what happened is witnesses and quite a few witnesses along the route who saw the Mercedes being pursued by several powerful motorbikes, and these motorbikes pursued the Mercedes down the expressway and into the Alma Tunnel, and which is where the crash occurred in central Paris. Now, the public have been told that the people riding those motorbikes were paparazzi, and the evidence shows that they were not paparazzi, because the paparazzi on the night were all accounted for. The official paparazzi were camped outside the hotel waiting for the something to happen. And when the Mercedes left, they jumped into their small cars and on their scooters and tried to pursue the Mercedes. And there was one paparazzi who was on a motorbike, but he was the only one. There was the fact that witnesses saw up to four or five motorbikes surrounding and pursuing the Mercedes shows that these couldn't have been paparazzi because the paparazzi weren't riding the motorbikes. So then that raises the question, well, who was it? And there was evidence that came out a couple of years ago in the Soldier Inn case, where his wife stated that the SAS, British SAS, were involved in the assassination and the killing of Diana, and that it was the SAS that were on those motorbikes. So that's the clearest evidence that we've seen, really, of who was on them. We know that there wasn't paparazzi, and therefore, because the motorbikes were pursuing, and the witnesses show that was a ferocious pursuit of the Mercedes, and into the Alma Tunnel. So the fact that it was a pursuit of that nature, then it raises the issue, did these people try and assassinate Diana? And when the Mercedes got into the tunnel, there was a white Fiat Uno that witnesses saw waiting for the Mercedes, going very, very slowly. And the Mercedes driver, Henry Paul, was being overtaken on the left-hand side by one of the motorbikes. And at the same time as that was happening, he was confronted with the white Fiat Uno ahead. So he had to make a decision about, a very instant decision, about whether he would hit the Uno or the motorbike, and apparently chose the Uno. And the motorbike got in front, and the pillion passenger on the motorbike had a strobe light and flashed that light into the driver, at the driver. And from that point, the driver, Henry Paul, lost control of the Mercedes because the strobe light's a very powerful flash, and it disorients the driver, and those lights are used by the SAS. And anyway, the Mercedes then sort of zigzagged, witnesses saw, and it crashed into the 13th pillar of the tunnel. But the result of the crash was that the two people on the passenger side survived, and the two people on the driver's side died instantly. So you had Henry Paul, the driver, in the front, and Dodi Fayed was directly behind him. Both of those men died instantly. And the people on the passenger side, which was Trevor Rees-Jones, he was on the front. He's still alive to this day. And Diana also survived the crash. So the evidence from the first medics to arrive was that Princess Diana, who was sitting in the back, had scored a 14 out of 15 on a Glasgow Coma Scale rating, which is a worldwide rating used to assess the head damage to the head of people in car crashes or in any crash of that sort of nature. And anyway, she rated 14 out of 15, which is very, very high. And the expert witness at the inquest said, well, she wouldn't be doing a Times crossword, but she was in very good condition considering what had happened. And what had happened was, of course, that she was sitting in the back, wasn't wearing a seatbelt. And there was a reason why she wasn't wearing a seatbelt, was because the seatbelt was jammed. That's something also the public are not aware of. And so So she, her body, on impact, it was a very high speed crash, 60 mile an hour into a concrete pillar, and her body did a 180 degree spin. She ended up sitting on the floor with her back against the front seat and her legs up on the back seat. So that was a cause for concern, of course, that there could be internal damage. And the evidence shows that what occurred was that there was a control over the ambulance, the arrival of the ambulance and the people in the ambulance on the night. And how they did it was the ambulance centre, there were two doctors on duty at the ambulance centre, were taking the calls from the crash scene and any other crashes in Paris that night. And the ambulance centre, the doctor who was on phone duty was actually working for intelligence agency, and he was the one that was able to control which ambulance went to the scene. And the ambulance actually, if you look at the timing of how quickly the ambulance got to the scene, it travelled at an average of about, I think it was about 9 kilometres an hour. So there was no rush for this ambulance to get to the scene. And it took, the crash was at 12:23, the ambulance arrived at 12:40. So it took 17 minutes. It was only a question of a couple of kilometres away from the ambulance centre where the ambulance left from. So this continued right through. It took 1 hour 43 minutes for Diana to arrive at the hospital. So people say, well, the French do it differently. They have a different system. They have a system called what it's called in the medical fraternity, it's called stay and play, whereas in the West or in the other Western nations like the UK and America, Australia, probably New Zealand, they have skip and run, where they pick up the person who's injured in the car crash and they just rush them to hospital. Whereas in France the system is different, and they will, the ambulance that comes has a lot more facilities on board, plus a doctor. And so things are done more slowly, but the issue is that Diana had an internal injury, had a likely internal injury given the impact that she had undergone. And these people are experts, they know this, and they knew that whatever internal injury she had could not be dealt with in an ambulance. Doesn't matter how good the facility in the ambulance is, her body had to be opened up to establish the issue and to try and deal with any injury. So when you look at the evidence of what occurred in the ambulance and the contacts between the ambulance and the base and all of the evidence about them pouring in these catecholamines, which were to increase her blood pressure, which actually at the inquest we found was not low enough to be that disturbed after that sort of crash. And the expert at the inquest said, well, you really just put your foot on the accelerator and get her to hospital rather than hanging around trying to increase her blood pressure. And the issue is, of course, if you put catecholamines into a person in that sort of condition where they could have an internal injury, then trying to increase the blood pressure will also increase pressure on the injury. And that's something also doctors know, you know. And so when you piece it all together and you look at the transcripts of what was actually said, things like there's documentary evidence from the ambulance report showing that they were aware she had a thoracic trauma, which is something you would expect. And as soon as they undressed her in the ambulance, they were aware of a thoracic trauma, and yet they... doctor speaking to the base was saying nothing for the thoracic, which is an extremely unusual thing to say, and he said that twice in the conversations to the base. And you know, why focus on what nothing for the thoracic? You'd be focusing on what the injuries are, so that when the ambulance gets to the hospital, then you've got the right specialist there to deal with this VIP patient. And so
it was almost like he was specifically corralling the doctors to avoid dealing with the actual injury.
Yeah, well, it's the middle of the night, and at the particular hospital they went to, the cardiothoracic specialist was at home in bed. And so he would have had to have been called ahead of time to get to the hospital. But by saying nothing thoracic here, make sure that there's not going to be any specialist there to actually deal with her when she arrived, and there wasn't. So as soon as she arrived, the doctor on duty, and there was nothing wrong with what the doctors in the hospital did. They did their best, but the doctor on duty there realised that there was thoracic trauma, hadn't been told that, and immediately they rang up the cardiothoracic specialist. But the problem was that, as I said, it was an hour and 43 minutes getting into the hospital, and there was even a 5-minute stoppage by the ambulance, and a couple of journalists outside the ambulance saw the ambulance rocking, and yet there was no cardiac massage or anything like that taking place at that, as said by the witnesses inside the ambulance. So why was that the case? Why did it stop for the 5 minutes, and why that did they arrive 5 minutes after that at the hospital at 2:06 a.m. and then Diana actually stopped breathing 6 minutes after they arrived? So because she was only alive for 6 minutes after the ambulance arrived, of course, calling the cardiothoracic specialist who's at home in bed, by the time he gets to the hospital, she's already stopped breathing.
It's kind of like a complete lapse in protocol, you know, like the movie Thoracic Park.
Yeah, that's right. And what it shows is that these people, and the evidence points to MI6 doing the operation, these people were focused on making sure that she didn't survive. It wasn't just a car crash that could scare her. That you can't, when you organise a car crash, you can never guarantee the person's going to die. And so just in case she survived, they had a backup plan through the ambulance. And it's a very, very shocking story, but that's what happened.
All right, thank you, John. Unfortunately, we've kind of run out of time for you to have now, unless, of course, you want to join us in the back in the second hour. For now, we're going to try and bring on Ben Vidgen. He's created a new Skype account, and hopefully the network will be able to connect him, or I might be able to even connect him myself if we're lucky. So, John, do you have a website there?
Yeah, there is a website. It's the address is www.princessdianadeaththeevidence.weebly, spelled weebly.com.
All right. Weebly's such a great website platform, I must say. So much easier for the non-technical fellows like us, eh?
Oh, no, that's right. It's been great. Yeah, very good.
All right, now we're going to try and get Ben Vidgen into the call if it's at all possible. And, John, I wish you the best of luck. And I think that you've kind of achieved what a lot of people want to achieve before they die. You've completed a great work to expose a grave injustice.
Yeah, well, thanks very much. Yeah, well, I'm just so pleased to have that work done, and I just hope it really sort of becomes well known of what actually occurred, because it's been a dreadful injustice, as you said.
Okay, well, we'll see about this, actually, because I don't know whether or not Ben's going to be even able to come on at the moment, and it's extremely frustrating for me. He's at a internet cafe, he's down to literally his last $3, and so he's spending the last of his money at that internet cafe.
Hello.
In order to be on this show. Here he is! Fantastic! Ben Vidgen, welcome to the program. Ben, can you hear me?
G'day.
Okay, excellent.
That's a really terrible photo you've got of me on Skype. How you doing, Vinny?
I'm wonderful, actually. John, would you be able to just press that little red hang up button and jump off the call here? We'll do with Ben here. All right, Ben. Well, we have a few minutes left in the segment. I would like you to quickly give us what you got, brother.
As you probably aware at the moment, the thing I'm focusing on is the TPPA, Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. We had amazing protests down here in Dunedin, New Zealand, 3,500 people. Dunedin's not a very large place, so that was a rather spectacular turnout. One of the things, however, I wanted to make clear, which will probably be of interest to both the New Zealand listeners as well as your American listeners, is that to me, the TPPA is really, it's just one battle in an entire war which is undergoing against people, against our sovereignty. And what I made a point is about in New Zealand, like, you know, we have a political system which a little bit like America is broken up between the Democrats and the Republicans, except for New Zealand, it's national representing kind of like the Republicans and Labour representing like kind of like the Democrats. But the point I made was that, you know, in New Zealand, we sort of tend to think of us as coming from national, but in actual fact, it was originally Labour introduced the TPPA. So really the enemy we're facing is not a partisan one. It's actually comes from an ideological philosophy, which I identify as neoliberalism. So, you know, in New Zealand, the question is they're bringing the TPPA, which they want to use it to kind of bring in a corporate Magna Carta. But at the same time, that's just one of the attacks that's going on sovereignty. We have the change of a flag, and the change of the Union Jack on the flag actually has a political ramification, because if you go back to the days of knights of old, the heraldry that was on a knight's shield represented whose power they operated and under what authority. It's literally called due authority. And in our case, if you refer to the parliamentary website's own reference, that Union Jack actually stands there. It's there on our flag to represent us of our democratic traditions. If you remove it, you're effectively saying, hey, we're bailing out of the democratic system. On top of that, what we're also undergoing in New Zealand is it's not just a flag change, because legally, the flag change by itself is not a big deal. But under the mechanics of government, it's the flag change we're facing, as well as the change to the head of our state. We've seen our court system has changed from the Privy Council, which again removes us from the Westminster Magna Carta protections, to one of the Supreme Court, where our judges are now picked by the very politicians who are wanting to bring in these laws that undermine our sovereignty. We're now also facing the introduction of a constitution. And in New Zealand, the constitution is a very big thing, because unlike America, we don't actually have one of those. Now, the thing about our constitution is, just like the TPPA, we're not being told what's in this constitution. And it's interesting, because when you look at the panel of experts that have been hired to make sure that we're aware of it and that it's all done publicly, consultation, it's all done with transparency. You have people like Peter Chin, and Peter Chin is the mayor of Dunedin, the city where I'm in. He sits on the panel of the flag as well as the panel for the constitutional panel. This is a guy who at the 43rd School of Foreign Policy in Otago, which is a very prestigious academic institution which discusses foreign policy. Peter Chin said, I don't really agree much with public consultation, generally because it gives the people who with an axe to grind or disgruntled a reason to drown out the silent majority. And when you sort of start finding bureaucrats talking about the silent majority, and their job is to kind of inform you, but they're not, you know, you start to kind of start to realise that there's a bit of a game going on there, and the game is rigged.
Now, here's the other thing. I recently saw a post by WikiLeaks. They did a video saying the US strategy to create a new global legal and economic system called the three big T's, and that's the TTP, the TPPA, the TTIP, and the TISA, which are basically saying what I've been saying for a long time. They're setting up a global government. Now, because I've been saying that for longer than WikiLeaks, that makes me a conspiracy theorist. And now,
of course, yeah. I have the same situation, and the reality is, Vinny, is, you know, I'm doing a book at the moment. I was writing about you the other day because, you know, you use languages like Illuminati, New World Order, and all the things that kind of like a fingernail on a chalkboard to me. But the reality is, regardless of the jargon you're using, I mean, other people call it the old boys network or the 1%. It still boils down to the same thing, the centralization of power. And in New Zealand, you know, I made this point. I'm saying, why is it that when we have a protest movement, the first people that get up and speak against the TPPA is Labour, followed by the Greens? Now, Labour helped bring in the TPPA. The Greens helped change the court system and want the flag changed, and they want all the other things. The reality is, Labor, Greens, National, they're three sides of the same pyramid, you know. And when you look at the front bench in New Zealand, if you look at all the leading senior MPs of all the parliament, they all belong to an organisation called Parliamentarians for a Global Action. It used to be called Parliamentarians for a New World Order. It's exactly this, this centralisation of power which belong to these umbrella groups, TPPA, MAI, Parliamentarians for Global Action, whatever you want to call it. But at the end of the day, it's talking about reducing the power so that there's one ring to bind them all, one ring to blind them all, and the darkness feed them on mushrooms.
Yeah, and ultimately what's really frustrating about the whole labelling of it, in fact, I'm going to completely abandon making that point, and I want to go on to something you said about Labour coming up and being the first person to speak. Well, I did put up a video of, I think it was it David Parker, I believe, from the Labour Party, speaking at the TPPA. 1 minute into his speech, the protesters started shouting him down because we all saw through the bullshit and we just went, you know what? This guy should just walk away from the TPPA. And he wasn't doing that. Just sitting there reading the script saying, we need to pass laws for this and that and the other. You're the one who helped cause all this.
I mean, the second time around this speech, Labour actually didn't turn up. And that's partly because I made a big deal about saying, you know, wait a minute. Listen, read the fine print. Labour's not saying no to the TPPA. They're saying our TPPA will be full of unicorns and fluffy bunnies. You know, they're actually saying they will still have a TPPA. So I'm saying, you know, this is an anti-TPPA protest, so they're not willing to get up and say no to the TPPA. They have no right to be here. And it's the same situation. I've had a lot of fight trying to get people to bring the flagish, you know, bring New Zealand flags along to the protest movement, because I'm pointing out the sovereignty issue, and the groups within the protest movement that link into Labour and Greens are going, oh no, don't mention the flag, don't mention the flag. I'm going, why not? It relates to sovereignty, and they don't want to mention the flag because they want to change it, because you know they are. You know, the Clayton's protest, they're the protests you have when you're not having protests. This is another arm of the government that comes along, they speak first, and it's the same job. We're meant to listen to what they say, but they won't actually listen to us. And what actually happens traditionally in the protests, and in fact, it's not just the TPPA, it's all the protest movements. Labour, Greens get up, they speak, they do the piece. The guys don't even march with us. You know, we get to the octagon, they're waiting for us, they do their speech, and then 5 minutes after they've done the speech, they bugger off and they don't listen to the rest of us. And if that isn't a big, huge finger in the ear, I don't know what actually is. It's like the reality is it should be if the politicians want to come and speak at a people's protest, they go to the back of the queue and they listen to what everyone else says, then they have their 5 cents, you know? And that's the point. I mean, if I have any point today, that is the thing I want to make clear to anyone. Any protest, whatever it's occurring, if MPs turn up and go, yep, sweet, you can speak, but you're at the back of the queue because this is the people's protest and your job is to listen to us, and we need to start reminding them that that is their job.
Yeah. Fuck yeah. I'm absolutely sick to death of it, bro. Going there and then having these people just wallow on and go, vote for me, I'll solve all the problems. Excuse me, bro. It's actually people trying to vote for other people to solve all their problems and not taking action that's allowed the problems to get so bad in the first place.
Entirely. And that is, again, is a big part of, you know, what I've been speaking about at these TPPA protests is, you know, don't wait for a political party to come and save you. You've got to be your own general. You've got to come up to these events, and it's not putting your piece of paper in a ballot every 4 years. That doesn't make democracy. Democracy is civic action where you participate in all the time, and that's writing letters to your newspapers, to MPs. It's turning up to these protests. It's going around talking to your neighbours in your own neighbourhood, explaining to them, you know, what this is all about. It's doing everything in your power 24/7 all the time, and not just saying, well, you know, I voted. That makes me Democrat, because, in other words, you're just allowing someone else to actually make the decisions for you and giving them away your power. And that is got to, people have got to make that cultural change, that they've got to realise that they are responsible for the power and start action. So when the politicians turn up to protest, it's like, sorry, bro, this is not actually for you. This is where you sit there and you listen to us. And if you're not willing to turn up, then you really just basically just made it very clear to us that you're not interested in doing your job. So now we'll be remembering that come the next election.
And let's not forget that there's 1,000 days in between New Zealand elections. don't give up the power of those 1,000 days that you can actually do something by yourself without casting a ballot. I'm not saying don't vote. I'm not saying that voting is a completely useless affair. I mean, personally, I only vote for the entertainment value. Who do I vote for? I vote for Winston. Why? Because he's freaking hilarious, and he insults all the and he insults the National Party people with really, really great things, and gets kicked out of the House of Parliament. He keeps the game more interesting.
Winston's, for those who outside of New Zealand understand, Winston's kind of like the Wyatt Earp of the political scene. He's there to kind of shoot things up and make things really interesting, and he does a really good job. A very astute guy, a lawyer. He's interesting because he's out of all the political parties, and I'm gonna just hold on for a second. This is not an endorsement of New Zealand First, because there are things in Winston's past which make him, you know, I'm equally dubious of Winston. But in saying that, he's the lesser of weebles in the sense of, he's the only one that's come up against, gone out against Agenda 21. He's the only one that's actually pointed out that actually, yes, the flag is significant on a constitutional basis to the issue of government. He's the only one that said no to the TPPA. You know,
He's also the only one that actually listened to the Mangawhai Ratepayers Associations about the local government corruption that they exposed there.
Oh, look, Tiley. I mean, I don't know if you saw during the by-election, there was a big picture of Winston Peters wrapped in the cloak of the Game of Thrones, and the caption was Warden of the North. Well, what was actually happening was I had some really good guys up in Northland that were telling me basically where all the gang police connections are and all the corruption issues were going. And what they were basically doing was they were feeding me the ammunition. They'll be my spotters telling me where the target was. I was then cranking the information, firing it directly onto the social media sites that I knew the mainstream media was actually following. The consequence of that was being picked up by New Zealand First. They were watching and they were bringing up and reacting to that. It was being picked up by the New Zealand media, so that on the election night, that photoshopped image that we'd been using, which by that stage had gone viral, they were actually using as the backdrop on TV3.
You know, I've got this real feeling as well that as things get worse, it becomes so much easier to find out who your allies are and who your enemies are by who has the toughest time and who gets the least media coverage.
My favourite saying at the moment, which is I'm using in my book, is Lieutenant, I think you're going to be surrounded. And it's like, well, we're paratroopers. We're meant to be surrounded. And this is the way I kind of look at, you know, at the moment, it does seem pretty tight. I wouldn't have it any other way, in the sense of the closer it gets constricted, the more people start to realise that all these years that I've been shouting and going on, that actually I haven't just been a lunatic, and then people start rallying around you, and it's amazing the people, that the support that you can actually get. But, you know, it's just a little bit sad that it kind of gets to the stage that it takes so long for people to realise that actually, you know, all those years that you're talking about organised crime existing, and you're talking about corruption in government, you know, it's taken me basically 15, 16 years for the mainstream media in New Zealand to catch up with what I was saying 16 years ago.
And, of course, they don't give you the recognition you deserve for being so far ahead of the curve.
Yeah, but you know what, Vinny, I don't really care about it. Like, on my Investigate social media page, we've had over 100,000 views reached this week. We're clicking over about 100 likes on that page a week. The information, like your show, is getting out to the people, which is what it's really all about. What I'm also finding is that I'm finding that a lot of people in mainstream media are actually starting to follow my network, and they come in and they, you know, I put footballs down on the playing field, and then they come along and they pick those balls up, and they don't always kick them as far as they like or take them as far, but the point is I'm managing to get those footballs on the playing field, which weren't there beforehand. And the last year, I'm actually really, really stoked by the number of stories which I've broken, which, you know, normally it takes me like anywhere from 2 to 3 years for them to catch up. Now I'm finding that, you know, I put a story out and within 2 or 3 days, I'm getting some direct feedback that ball has been picked up with and run with. So I'm pretty stoked. Guerrilla media, it's about what I call setting media landmines. You set things up so that you know they're going to walk into the story, and then they grab it and think it's their own story. But in reality, you just pry them because, you know, every sucker likes a hook.
Yeah. Yeah. Personally, I want to sort of replace the mainstream media ultimately because, you know, look, their audiences are dropping sharply, right? And let's have a look at who has been critical of the national government in the media and how many of them still have a job.
Well, you know, the classic example would be, and again, this is one where you and I have direct connection, is Brooke Sabin. And we were covering the corruption, well, the election fraud case of John Banks in the High Court. And, you know, we're out there and Brooke Sabin turns up and he's covering the story and he goes away and he does a fluff piece. And this is what he always does. He's always in support of John Banks and in support of National. Nowhere do they ever point out to you that Brooke Sabin is the son of Mike Sabin, who's the MP that's just lost the seat election because of police, because he's facing trial. Yeah. And this guy makes his living by basically being an apologist for the National Party. And this is true of Mike Hoskins, and it's true of Paul Henry. And then the only guy he's sort of fairly tame in comparison, was John Campbell. And we saw what happened to John Campbell. He had a high-rating television show. So with John Campbell's case, you know, he had a high-rating show. And bang, you know, because he was actually doing his job, pointing out things like the GCS surveillance bills, he was pointing out the TPPA, they actually got rid of him. And that's what's happening in mainstream media transparently. I mean, I did a timeline and I showed from effectively the last 10 years how bit by bit laws are passed in New Zealand, which actually removed all the protections, which mean that there needs to be a certain amount of percentage devoted towards current affairs. And bit by bit, all that's been removed. And now that they've got it removed, you know, you're seeing that the news is getting shorter, the current affairs programs that are on Sunday are gone. You know, the quality of media that we've had in the mainstream media versus 15 years ago to what it is now is huge. And yet most people aren't really kind of noticing that, or alternatively, they're going to alternative media like yourself and me.
Well, that's because there is no real alternative. And I don't want to say that. I mean, obviously the alternatives are out there and they can be sought out. They won't be put in front of your face, though. They won't be broadcast on your mainstream television channels, though. They won't be given a weekly spot. They won't be sponsored by Coke. They won't be sponsored by ASB. The revolution will not be televised.
Oh, hell no. But, you know, that does lead me to another point, which I'm, you know, today is a classic example. Like, you know, I've been waiting for the last 2 weeks for clients to pay me, and I'm literally like down to my last couple of dollars. Being independent media is a tough, self-funded job. But in saying that, you know, I've been working in the infrastructure for the last 2 years. Well, by the end of this year, I've got something which I'm going to be launching nationwide, which I'm hoping will actually generate me a good income. But, the problem with a lot of independent media is that they have the skill as independent journalists, but not necessarily the marketing skills, and you do actually need them both of them.
Yeah, and that's another thing as well. When you're a one man band, it can be there's simply too much work to do for any one person to do. And I've only just approached that point within the last week that I realised I need help, and I asked for it, and now I'm getting it. I'm getting people to edit the Vinnie Eastwood Show audio archives for me. I'm getting one person to do a little bit of the video. I'm getting a lady to write up the descriptions for me. So it's been working quite well.
Well, I agree with that too, and it's, you know, as I said, goes back to the statement. In this fight, you have to learn to be your own general. And, you know, the first thing you do is, you, in any military tactical situation, is you identify the problem, which in this case is we are without leadership, so therefore we must become our own generals. The second thing you do when you're being your own general is you have to create your own army, which means rallying the troops. And this is a from a media viewpoint, it's not something that happens in a day. And you're telling me that about how you're starting to bring in people to assist you. Good on you, Vinnie, because, you know, that's often what you can't do it all in one day. But it's also a skill in itself to actually be able to kind of work with volunteers, because you've got to be able to, understand that they are volunteers, not push them too hard because they don't necessarily have the same drive and passion as you do. You've got to also kind of like let your hands off so that, you know, the people that are good at skills, you actually let them get on with what they're doing. That in itself is an actual art form, and it's something which I'm learning over a period of time. But generally, you know, the point of the matter is I've been doing this for 15 years. I've been moving step by step. You know, every year I double what I did the year beforehand. My main page now, my social media page now, is reaching in a week, over a week's period. We're now reaching over 100,000 in a reach capacity. You know, we're getting good numbers, and it's taken a lot of hard work to get there. But I almost feel like my time has come. You know, as we face these kind of difficult times, more and more people turn to the independent media, and they're turning away from mainstream media. So, you know, all this, I guess you could say what I've been going through is a very long-term apprenticeship, and now I'm really kind of ready to kind of get in there and kick ass.
Well, you weren't an apprentice, you were an intern.
My own intern.
I'm my own intern.
I'm a too nice and complicated situation.
I work myself really long hours and don't give myself any money.
Well, you know, it's me too. I mean, you know, but in saying that, you know, I have put infrastructure in place, and I do believe in the next, you know, I mean, for me personally, like I ran a cafe 7 years ago, and actually it wasn't the media that brought me into trouble. My media side of business has always done really well. It was the cafe that put me under, and I've had to climb out of that. I'm basically back to a point now where I'm just about back in the black, and then next year we'll be able to kind of capitalize on it. So, you know, it's been a very expensive learning curve from that viewpoint, but I'm really pleased with the results. I just want to kind of get back to this issue of the TPPA and the New Zealand flag. Like, What I've actually managed to do is, again, using social media, I've managed to get people to this idea that when they get out there and they march against the TPPA, they should bring the New Zealand flag along. And it's not about confusing the issues, flag, blah, blah. It's about saying we are protecting the sovereignty of our country, and this is what we believe in, and this is what we stand for. We don't want your corporate branding. Thank you very much, John. We want the flag that represents our democratic traditions as is stated in our own parliament. So, you know, what I managed to do was with the Octagon, we got up there and I managed to get all the New Zealand flag guys up the front. We had a marching so that they were quite prominent. When I got to the Octagon, I climbed up on Robbie Burns and I planted the New Zealand flag, and someone came along and pulled it down. So I went back and put it back up again. I felt like Connie Hickey in reverse, actually. But, you know, it was very apparent that my message was working. I saw the New Zealand flags and other protests throughout New Zealand. And I really, really want, that's the image I want people to see when they see the TPA protest. Because if you're Mr. and Mrs., you know, middle class sitting at your home.
I think we're coming to break now, Ben. I'm sorry, well, we don't have any more time.
Done.
We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for listening to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. It's listener supported, so please go there and start up a regular automatic payment today to support the broadcast. We'll be right back. And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, on the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide. Just because you're being exterminated doesn't mean you can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? And my very special guest joining me is Ben Vidgen, live from Dunedin, the most Scottish city in the country. Welcome.
Oh, for sure, Vinnie. We actually have an expression for the people that rule the city down here. We call them the Tartan Mafia. We're talking beforehand about the issue of the media and the New Zealand flag and the TPPA. And as I'm sort of thinking about this in the break, I've been thinking, you know, one of my goals is to try and get that New Zealand flag actually out onto the TPA rallies, because to me, it's actually a statement saying, no, we want to protect our sovereignty. It's also bringing the point that the TPPA is just one battle in a war against that sovereignty. Now, what's been interesting is that none of the mainstream media have actually turned around and talked about the Union Jack on the New Zealand flag, which is not about the Britain. It's not there for the Great Britain. It represents the New Zealand's part of the Westminster system, which ties us into the Magna Carta. So it's there to remind us that we are a democratic nation. That's its entire heraldry purpose. Now, that's not being mentioned once in any of the media, and it's been very interesting because you can always know when you're onto something, because if they think they've got you wrong, they'll turn around and come out with, you know, the words of conspiracy theorists, blah, 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 blah. But when they won't talk about what you're talking about, you know that you're saying something. It's interesting too, because then what happens is what we're seeing is the polls in New Zealand have been outstandingly saying, no, we don't want to change the flag. So the next thing you start to see is down here in Dunedin, in the land of the Tartan Mafia, the local mainstream paper starts putting on every day, not just once, twice, occasionally, every day, even though they've been telling that people don't want to change the flag, they've been putting newspaper articles on page two written by various people telling us about why they're going to vote for a new flag, or why the flag change is quite good. What's interesting is what you're actually noticing here is Public Relations Marketing 101, and it comes from the firm Textor and Crosby. They helped to bring in the Conservative government in the United Kingdom. They helped bring in Tony Abbott's government in Australia. They certainly helped bring in John Key's government. And what they do is they do a policy where they repeat a lie, and they do this by paying journalists or putting up perks to them. So they repeat a lie, they have it on talkback radio, in the mainstream newspapers, so they repeat it again and again and again till people start to believe that lie. And what Textbook and Crosby are doing, they call it marketing, but in actual fact, it comes directly from Joseph Goebbels' own playbook about repeat the lie, repeat the lie, repeat the lie.
Well, let's face facts here. The media has been compromised for a long, long time. It's in, whoever's controlling it isn't on the side of the people. Now, the journalism as a profession, as far as I know from the journalists I know, it's a responsibility to the country, to freedom and of speech, and just generally, it's a dedication to the truth for the truth's sake. That in that order, right? And it seems to me that the Fourth Estate, almost to a large degree, does not exist in any official capacity, and any real journalism has sort of subsided underneath it, sort of like a tectonic plate.
I'm a dinosaur, Vinny. I represent, I'm a social pariah to my colleagues within the mainstream media. I got brought up in a family where we had lots of media contact. We were culturally old school. These were the guys that chain smoked, they lived, breathed, talked politics. That was today, when you go and meet a lot of mainstream media guys, you know, what they're interested in is how much money they're earning a year, what car they're driving, and you start to talk to them about serious media issues, they become observably uncomfortable. They're basically not journalists. They're public relations media whores in disguise. And in New Zealand, we see our Minister of Communication was Stephen Joyce, who used to run Media Works. He put it hugely into debt. And then he left that, having, you know, messed that company up. He went into Parliament, became the Minister of Communication. He then employed basically people that were pro-national to fix Media Works, but all they've done is their ratings have shrunk and become worse, and their debt has actually increased. They filled all the mainstream newspapers, all the editors, all the radio stations, all the TV stations are all full of people that are either literally card-carrying members of the National Party or actively, you know, promote that neoliberalism policy with their own people. And anybody that stands up and shows that they actually, it's almost a death sentence. If you actually mention the word neoliberalism, you can guarantee that someone's going to come along and remove you from your post, because that's the one thing. They don't like when you mention neoliberalism. You could say, it's National's fault, it's Labour's fault, it's the Greens' fault. But when you turn around and start to say, actually, no, it's actually what we're facing is neoliberalism, or Nazi light, as I like to call it, that's when they get uncomfortable, because you've just identified the enemy.
That's the problem that I see as well, is even the good people on the inside, people with a conscience, they can't act on their conscience without getting fired, bro.
Well, they have to work really, really hard to do it. And even still, you know, I mean, it's, you know, I've got a lot of friends of mine who work in the mainstream media, and they are good, you know, people, and they do good stories. But they also, a lot of them tend to have kids, and they've got mortgages. So at the back of their mind, they're thinking, you know, if I'm the guy that keeps coming to the editor with the stories that he has to send to the legal department, or, you know, that in turn is going to have the Prime Minister ringing up and giving that guy a hard time, I'm not going to get the pay rise. I'm not going to get the promotion. So the journalists start to become self-censoring. And a friend of mine, Trace Hodgkins, who some of you out there might know, he's a New Zealand award-winning cartoonist of the year twice. He used to be in virtually the Dominion, the New Zealand Herald, the Lister, you name it. You know, I was speaking to him again as part of my book project last year, and he was straight out saying, he says, you know, it's I can't do my job anymore, because as soon as I do a cartoon of the Prime Minister, the Prime Minister rings up the editor and chews him out. Then the editor then turns around and chews him out. So he says, you know, in the end, it's like he's basically been forced out of a job which he's recognised as having award-winning status in.
Yeah, and that's the general hypocrisy. And it becomes quite clear how the country can be, shall we say, ushered into a direction that it doesn't want if the very people, the very institutions, if the very apparatus with which is supposed to give them the information with which to make good decisions has been completely compromised. The chances of people waking up en masse and rejecting things, it doesn't evaporate completely. As long as people realise that they should not be relying on the compromised media for their information or their motivation.
Entirely. And again, I was interviewing another guy, which was really interesting, down part of my book project, a guy called Bernie Proctor, and he used to work literally directly under Rupert Murdoch. And I was asking him about, you know, what's his thought, his thoughts were on the media, and he said, Ben, you know, never in a world has people been had access technologically to such information, but the nature of the media has now become trivialized, and unless it entertains, it's very hard to get a media out there that people will actually act on. And the reality is, I see this in Dunedin. Like, you know, I've been doing what I do for 10 years, and there's a little click of a there's a little click of would-be intellectuals that kind of sneer down their nose at me, and I'm like, okay with that. Because they turn around and they kind of poo-poo what I'm doing, because I guess I make them feel a little bit stupid. What's interesting is that when the protests come around, these guys who think that they know so much and are so superior to everybody else, they're nowhere to be seen. It's actually the people out on the street who may not necessarily have the university degrees, but that are passionate and they want to learn, and they may not necessarily have all the tools, but they're doing the best they can to find that information, and they're the ones that are out on the street, and they are the patriots, and those are the people for whom I work for. They're the people who get what I'm about. And, you know, and thank you very much for all the people, you know, that's out to you there. If you're one of those people out there, thank you very much, because your feedback really keeps me going.
It is a symbiotic relationship I've found between the alternative media and the audience, because to a large degree we have a reliance on each other. The audience rely on us to give them information and to you know, basically help them in a way the media is supposed to. But at the same token, we don't have an operation without that audience.
No, we don't. And you know, the role of the media has also maybe changed a wee bit in terms of, you know, once upon a time, you know, we were the collectors of information, and then we get that information and we give it to the people. People can do that themselves now. So what our job is really about is actually getting through to people that, you know, it's great that you're interested, it's great that you're curious, it's great that you collect information, but our job is now to say to people, okay, how do you quantify that information? How do you make sure that the information that you've got is actually reliable? And it's our job to teach people how to analyze and become critical thinkers, because that's, I mean, you know, if you're a person that's you brought up a family that doesn't have a silver spoon in your mouth, and you've got a great intelligence, but you never had the chance to go to university or train technically on information, you might be really good at collecting information, but you don't necessarily have the tools to be able to work out what's reliable and what's not. And that's where people like me, us come in, because we start to teach you ways about how you can authenticate that information, how you can check that information, how you can corroborate that information. So we start giving people the tools so that they can start to actually be better soldiers of information. You know, at the end of the day, information is a weapon, but sometimes it needs people to come along and teach you how to use that weapon. And that's kind of what I see the independent media really about. It's not just about collecting information, it's about teaching people how to use those weapons effectively.
Also, collaboration without a hierarchical structure tying it all down and some kind of centralized authority. That's what I think is the true strength of alternative media, and that's what gives it its longevity and its lack of overarching debt to broadcasting standards authority and so on and so forth.
Well, and I think you're right, because, you know, especially on social media, like I have to remind myself sometimes, you know, I'll turn around, I'll put a post, and someone will come along and say, well, you know, how do you find out about this, or, you know, what about this? And part of me kind of goes, you know, like, hey, I've just spent 2 hours on a story and information, and you want me to go and give you some more information, or, you know, and you go, and you go, wait a minute, actually, this person is curious and they want to find out more. They're doing you a service by coming to your page, so it behooves you to actually answer everybody that comes to your social media page. The only thing, for me, it's like, I don't mind if people critique what I'm doing. What I don't tolerate is, on my own page, I don't tolerate profanity. I'm not their anger management counselor, and I don't tolerate being abused, you know. So if people come on the page and they're like, oh, I don't necessarily agree with this, or I think you got this wrong, great, you know, fantastic. I'm not infallible. And having that direct relationship with my media, with my audience, is really essentially part of modern independent media.
Well, it means you're also accountable to your audience. How many of the mainstream media are currently accountable to their audience?
Oh, none, none. And if you actually notice one of the interesting things, and again, you know, when you, you know, for example, I go back to this New Zealand flag thing, you know, I would love to be able to go to some of these newspaper articles that go up telling us that isn't changing the flag and getting rid of the Union Jack such a great idea. But oddly enough, you actually notice that a lot of these mainstream media are now removing the comment section from their newspapers because that gives people a chance to say, what about this? How come you haven't mentioned this? And they don't like that. They don't like being held accountable for their actions.
I actually did notice that, and I started to wonder why. And I see this is also happening starting to do, because not only is there a real alternative media, there's a fake alternative media too, isn't there?
Oh, yeah.
And that really pisses me off. It's kind of like... I'm a 6'4" white guy, and so therefore I'm racist kind of mentality, you know? and it seems to me that you can't be differentiated by people who do no investigation. And so if one person comes out and says, like, completely crazy, crazy stuff time and time again, and people call them a conspiracy theorist, and you come out and you say crazy, crazy stuff that's actually backed up by evidence, and you provide the source links and all of that kind of stuff, and you still get called a conspiracy theorist, and you still get thrown into that that bad barrel with everybody else kind of thing, because the person who's criticizing you hasn't investigated the differentials between yourself and your credible journalism and somebody else who's making shit up.
Well, you know, I mean, I make that point myself, and I'm not going to mention the person in question that I tend to grind my teeth with because that would be giving them power. But, you know, there's a person out there that he surely kind of mirrors a lot of stuff that I've done in the past. But, you know, the interesting thing, and he has a huge following. It's amazing how huge his following is. But the point that I always make out is he'll make these statements which, you know, he has never has any source material that he can quote. He never has witnesses that are on the record. He never has documented material to back up what he's saying. So he just says this stuff, which is kind of similar to what I'm saying, but a little bit different and to be quite honest, a little bit crazier. And bang, you know, people accept it because they haven't learned that thing of it's not good enough just to believe it because it fits your belief system. You've got to be able to corroborate that information. If that person provides you information and can't back it up with some primary documentation with multiple witnesses, then, you know, you don't go up that tree. But it's frustrating because, you know, you're trying to get out there and do independent media and this person's coming along and it's similar enough to what you're doing that people can go, oh, you're just like so-and-so. You're a conspiracy theorist, and it means that your work gets tainted by the efforts. However, you know what I do, and which I think I have quite good results on, is that I've been doing this now for 20 years. And if you go back and you check my track record, I, in actual fact, there's very few stories I've ever done, which a couple of years down the road, the mainstream media actually have now accepted as being that actually is actually happening. So, you know, for me, they can call me whatever they like. Anyone that actually bothers to do the research will realize that I've actually got an incredibly good track record of getting stories out there. I've got I'm very widely respectable in the mainstream media at the moment. I mean, they won't mention my name, but you know, there's very, very, very few tables that I can't sit down at, and they won't know who I am and say, how you're doing. Most of the time what they say to me is like, I wish I could do what you're doing. And I sit there, you know, the other one's buying the drinks, the other got the platinum and Visa card, and I'm broke again. And I go, oh, really? Why is that? And I said, well, you know, you've got the freedom to do these stories and you do them how they should be done. I said, well, why don't you do that? He says, well, you know, I like my platinum and Visa card. Thank you very much. So, you know, it's frustrating, but it's sort of interesting because you do get the in-house kudos. You just don't get that outhouse acknowledgement.
Just victims of the in-house drive-by.
Yeah, pretty much all. But, you know, that's at the end of the day, if I didn't like it, I could always run away and go do something else and actually probably, you know, I'm not a person that hasn't made an income in the past. I've just decided. You know, I used to work for Alan Jones and 2U. It was the first job I had working for corporate media. I lasted about 8 weeks before, you know, we mutually decided that it wasn't for me. And I decided I never wanted to go back into that world because it was just so toxic and so full of lies, I just couldn't bring myself to do it. And I spent, that would have been the early mid-90s, and I came back to New Zealand. I wrote my first book. It was a bestseller. It sold a huge amount of copies by New Zealand standards. Didn't get mentioned in a single newspaper review in this country. I spent the next couple of years basically, you know, serving tables and restaurants And then I started my own media app, and I've been every year I've been building and getting bigger and bigger and building on and building on, and I'm getting there. And I'm doing it because of the thing that I love. And you know, today's, you know, like, no one's paid and it's getting tight and it's frustrating because you need to pay the bills. But at the same time, you know, I sat down last night and looked at what I've been reading and the people I've been meeting, and I was thought, you know, I love my job. There's no way in the hell I'd give it up.
I think that it's not a job. It's something else, isn't it?
It's an adventure, mate. It's not a job. It's an adventure.
It's life.
It is, and I had a great life. And I mean, this is completely off the subject, but one of my a very essential point to the book that I'm writing, because, and I'll get back to that in a second. That'll actually come out in November, and I'd love you to have me on the show about that. But one of my dear friends, Chris Meader, passed away about 3 years ago, and Chris was 39. He died of leukemia. And I just recently went and saw his exhibition, because they did a posthumous art exhibition. It was a sculpture. And I knew that Chris was a great sculpture, but I didn't realize when I went to the exhibition and read the book by his friends and all the, you know, noting all the adventures that he'd done and all the movies that he worked on, I went, man, this guy has lived a life. You know, his legacy is what he's accomplished. And to me, that's, you know, that's the thing. I know I can walk out to the door today, get hit by a bus, and I know, you know, for what I've done in my 45 years, I've accomplished a lot. And yeah, things get tight, but the number of times that I've had people come up and they have said to me, you know, hey man, thank you for writing that, because that made a really big change in my life, and it stopped me from doing drugs, or I didn't commit suicide, or I went off and became a journalist. And these are all things that people have said to me, has made me gone, wow, you know, actually, you know, I know I'm just a silly little hobbit down at the bottom of the Shire in the big little Middle Earth of the world, but I seem to actually have some impact, and so there's no way in the hell I'd actually give this up.
Well, it's a compulsion. What was it Bruce Willis said on Armageddon? Is the only one of your age bracket, Grace. It's not a choice, it's a lack of options.
Exactly. You know, and same with this book project I'm working on, which is, it's called Ben's New Zealand. What I did was I traveled from the top of New Zealand to the bottom of New Zealand, which for American, you know, this is like, you know, my book's basically Welcome to the Real Middle Earth. I show you all the real Maori myths and legends. You know, everything in Lord of the Rings, New Zealand already actually had before there was even a Lord of the Rings. But what I also did was I went along the way and I interviewed people that were doing things in technology and sustainability and building communities, which is, you know, I interviewed you and I interviewed Dr. Sam Shea. And this is a book about what I realized was you can't save the world. You can't save the world. You can't even save the people that you love sometimes. But what you can do is you can create a legacy where you help inspire people, and if you're lucky, you can put people in connections that can build little life rafts, and from that a seed can be built. And for me, this book was really, really important, because, you know, for, you know, close on 25 years now, I've chased bad guys, and I mean bad guys, and I've been in some, over the years, some pretty tricky situations, but, you know, very few of them ever went to jail, and very few of them, I never managed, you know, very few of them anything really ever, I felt there was a sense of accountability, and I started to get to a point where I started feeling incredibly depressed and incredibly feeling like I had no power and just feeling toxic and hating everything and hating myself. And then I went off and I did this adventure. And this book was basically about saying no to fear porn, not buying into spreading more fear, and saying, you know, how can I find something that I can actually tell people a story in a way that there is some degree of accountability, but also there is a way that people can gain something from this, and that some real change can occur. And this book's full of it. It's got, you know, I've got some great ideas, but I've also got people who've got some really common practical things that they can do in their own lives to improve their own lives.
I was just thinking about this the other day. So somebody told me that I'm not accomplishing anything and that I should just quit what I'm doing and such and such. And as evidence, he presented the fact that things just keep getting worse despite the fact that I'm exposing it and interviewing people about it and helping people, etc., etc. So therefore, I'm accomplishing absolutely nothing and it's not worth my time. And I'm like, well, hold on a second, bro. Did I cause all the world's problems by myself? No. Well, but you expect me to solve all the world's problems by myself or just quit what I'm doing, right? Here's the thing.
You're Captain New Zealand, man.
It's the ripple effect.
Okay, you know, so
can I just finish this this point? Because there've been a number of people in my life that I've bumped into that I've done stuff for, done stuff with, and they've gone on to do other things that wouldn't have happened if I wasn't there at that particular time. In some cases, they wouldn't be alive right now if it weren't for me, because they were at the lowest point that they'd ever been in their life. Everything that they'd ever earned had been taken from them, and nobody would listen to them, nobody would help them, nobody would give them coverage except me. And just knowing that there is at least one person out there who's willing to help you in your darkest times stops it from happening to you, right? That darkness lifts because you know you're not alone. And that's the whole reason why I'm doing this, ladies and gentlemen. Even if I'm not being the most effective, even if I'm not being the most credible journalist, I'm just doing it because nobody else in New Zealand is doing a 5-day-a-week radio show with all of the videos and things of that nature, going to the protests, publishing the videos of all the speakers and things of that thing on my own time, on my own dime, that kind of thing. Just being here, just being visible, can stop people from feeling like they're alone. And that's a noble endeavor, I think.
Oh, for sure. But, you know, incredible by whose standards, because the way I look at it, Vinny, is it's like, and again, you know, this is what I'm writing about you in my book. You know, I say what you do is you give people a platform to get up and actually present an idea. And it doesn't matter. I mean, there'd be plenty of people on your show, to be honest, Vincent, that are, you know, they, by my standards, are way out there. I mean, I'm talking whacka, 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 whacka. But the point of the matter is, they still have a right to express their ideas. They've still got interesting things to say. I've never heard a show that you've done that I haven't walked away and learned something that I hadn't heard beforehand. You know, my opinion about what media is meant to do is give people ideas so that they can see all these different perspectives, and from that they judge themselves. It's only this modern construction of media that says, oh, no, you're meant to present the media as along these ways, which is absolute horse manure. So in actual fact, according to the standards of how I perceive media, you're old school media, and you're actually one of the few people in the country that are left that are actually doing your job the way it was meant to be done. It's you are the one of the rarest things out there, Vincent. You are a free thinker. And this is this misconception that when we go along and we do a newspaper story, we look at something that we've got to believe in the National Party, we've got to believe in Labour, we've got to believe in the Greens, we've got to believe in their philosophy, and you can only believe this, but you can't believe that. Who says that? The reality is, and in some ways, I reckon there should be a law out there that says that if you decide to be a journalist, you're actually banned from voting, because only from where you can turn around and say, look, you know, I come to this table without any particular agenda, can your audience then know that you can be relied upon because you're not coming with a fixed bias already. So that's what you do. You don't have a fixed bias. You just provide people that platform. And then I turn around and look, you know, things about, you know, the impact that you make. I mean, it's just people in this day and age, they get more and more depressed every time they turn on the news or listen to the mainstream media. They know they're not being told the story. They are not being given any answers. You come along and you give your viewpoint. And again, you give people some way to kind of go, well, you know, maybe I don't know everything, or maybe I'm still learning, but actually I'm not a complete lunatic for thinking this, or, you know, this is interesting. I hadn't thought about that new idea. So to me, that's a huge thing. And then I go to the situation of on your avatar, you have the New Zealand flag, and I look at you as Captain New Zealand. You're out there. You've got that big New Zealand flag out there. You're going, this is what I'm a Kiwi, and I get to stand up and say what I actually believe, and I don't have to apologise for my viewpoints. If I'm pro-pot, or I choose to believe in things like the Illuminati or New World Order, I've got a right, because that's what being a Kiwi is actually all about. And this is why we get to fly that flag, because this is what being democracy is. Democracy is not like, oh, you can only believe in this, because if you don't believe in this, then you're a loser. Because that's the Goebbels attitude again. It's creating the standard of what's right and being the winners and the losers. And that's not what democracy is about. Democracy is about us all working together.
Well, there's a quote here: without deviation from the norm, progress is not possible.
That's entirely.
Frank Zappa.
Frank Zappa for president. This is entirely the situation, is that we need our media out there not to turn around. I mean, again, every time I watch the news on New Zealand, I turn on the news and a story comes up, and somebody like Mike Hoskins or Paul Henrings once the news clip is finished, will chip in with a throwaway line about what he thinks about that story. To me, every time that happens, I just want to put a boot through the television because, you know, it's not his job as a media person to tell us what to think. His job is to present the information and then let us decide. And if they can't even get that right, you know what? They don't deserve to be there.
Yeah, that's something that's been occurring to me lately. And I want to go back to what you were saying just before about some of the people that come on the show are just like crazy. Yeah. And actually, there's a reason why I do that. And some of them actually sound really crazy to me, even. and I walk away from some shows going, I'm not interviewing them again, you know. but here's the reason why I do it. It's exactly what I said in the last hour. Those who condemn without investigating first aren't doing their job properly.
Exactly.
Here's someone out, all right? You give them enough rope, and they will either tie it around a real strong tree and they will pull you underneath the shade and get you out of that hot sun of ignorance, or they will have enough rope to hang themselves. That's more or less what happens when you're really open and accepting to people. They believe that they can say what they truly think without being judged. And that's the whole point of this show. And ultimately, that is what journalism, in my opinion, should be about. And it's interesting because those questions, the who, what, when, where, why, and how, these ultimate trivium aspects of journalism of how do you confirm facts as facts, you know, how many sources you got to have to back it up. I recall one time I saw a meme, and it actually had all the principles of journalism on it. And I was reading through them, and this is, I think, maybe in my third year of activism doing the YouTube and only just gotten my radio show. And I looked at all these journalistic principles, and I noticed two things. Number one, the mainstream media doesn't follow a single one of them.
No.
And number two, I was following every single one of these journalistic principles without even knowing what they were.
Yeah.
I was just an honest person doing an honest job. And apparently, that's one of the rules.
And that also, you know, the same thing happens in academia, in that, you know, I see a lot of people come out from an academic background, and I sit there and go, people going, for years, oh, there's no such thing as a new world order, there's no such thing as Illuminati, that's all ignorance, that's all conspiracy theory. Then we fast forward, and now people start talking about things like a centralized government, we talk about the TPPA, we talk about the 1%. I'm going, oh, come on, guys, step back a second. You're just using this different words for the same thing that these people were talking about 10 years ago. And they've actually been proved correct by events in hindsight. But in modern academia, the rules of methodology, going about checking your information, footnoting, you know, it really is a situation where people can just go along and present something and let the facts fall over where they are and say, this is the conclusion. Most of the time, people write doctorates. They've already got a fixed opinion. They know what the person marking the essay is going to say, so they fix that piece of work to be praised by that particular dogma, so that they're already brainwashing themselves and saying that they're academics when they're actually not following academic methodology. It happens all the time.
They're actually crazy, and this is why I call them academia nuts.
Yeah, well, that's pretty good. I mean, you know, again, it's interesting. Like, one of the guys I actually interviewed in my book was a guy called Kerry Strongman. He's and if you're out there, Kerry, awesome guy, by the way. He's a master carver, a Kamatu, which is like a Maori elder. I was talking to Kerry, and he's presenting all these sort of ideas, which, from my viewpoint and my background, are quite new age, and my eyebrows raising. And then he sort of looks at me every time he'd say something. He'd look at me and realize that it wasn't quite going in. So he would reword it in a way that was basically talking about old-fashioned common sense in indigenous shamanism. And I was going, oh, yeah, okay, that makes sense. And the really crazy thing about what Kerry was saying was that I'd go away and check things actually out and check with different scientists. And a lot of things that he was using New Age terms for actually – they have the equal in science. So when we have people on your show sometimes, and some of the things that they say come out and they appear to me crazy, you know, I also, there's another voice in the back of my mind who's saying, hey, man, you know, you only know X amount of the world, and listen to what these people are saying, because you might actually learn something. And I'm aware that, you know, I've only got a certain pay grade. I don't even understand my reality can be translated to me. I realize there are things out there which are stranger than heaven and earth, Horatio. And that's what I love about your show, because you do bring these people out there that just kind of, you know, they peel back and you get to see things that are maybe a little bit deeper. Sometimes you do have people on the show that I think are genuinely quite nuts, but most of the time you have people that are actually, they're free-thinking individuals and they're not letting themselves get constrained by this false version of media and this false version of academia, which more often than not tries to profess that it's something that it's actually not. It doesn't even live by its own rule book.
Mm. Even the nuts ones have their own value, because have you ever noticed that even when somebody tells you a big story or something like that, it's still very interesting?
Oh, entirely. And I mean, the other thing too is, I mean, you know, it also depends sometimes about how you listen, because you can be listening to someone that's nuts, and if you listen to them like strictly what they're saying and just that value, you get irritated and you're going to, but then if you actually listen beneath the subtext and you start to think about where they're coming from and what caused it, you can sometimes find that by what they're telling you, that may not necessarily be the information that they want you to hear, but you still hear and you get to learn something that's really important. So, you know, give everybody their dues, because everybody's got something to teach.
That's the spirit of the State of Israel. Give everybody their dues. All right.
Ooh. You know, see, you know, for me, that's an interesting one too, because, you know, on this thing I did about Jew authority, people went, oh, is that anti, you know, that's anti-Jewish. And I'm like, no, it's with a D, not a J. And then they turn around and I'd say, and that particular piece that I've done on Jew authority has been picked up. And I have a problem, because it has appeared on different sites and they link it into design. And I'm kind of, it's not that I don't believe, let me rephrase this. The point is they took my information, they tweaked it without checking in with me. And I think that's out of order. But in terms of, you know, I look at situations and I go, you know, when people, I do believe that Zionism is a powerful force. The difference is, if you go and approach Orthodox Jews, they also believe this, you know. The question is, Zionism is not a religious issue, it's a political ideology. Judaism itself is quite a wonderful and clever religion.
Yeah, I was listening to a big debate today between, I think it was, what's his name, David Duke, have you heard of him?
That the KKK horrible man.
Yeah, and I was watching this debate between him and another alternative talk radio show host, and, you know, it's actually quite interesting, because everybody who, almost everybody to this point, apart from mainstream establishment people who you're kind of told to love and get plenty of media attention, have plenty of money and things like that, anybody who's basically broke gets demonized in the media or something like that. I'm very interested to find out who they actually are, because I know for a fact that there's no way I can tell anything about them by what I'm hearing on the media. And I was just sitting there listening to this debate, and he's making some very, very interesting points. And he's also saying, I'm not a white supremacist. I want everybody to have human rights, real human rights. I'm more or less just an anti-Zionist, which is a belief structure, not a race.
I honestly don't know too much. I mean, I don't know a hell of a lot about David Duke. I know a little bit about the KKK, and everything I've seen about the KKK churns my guts and makes me want to vomit. But I do understand what you're saying, Vinny, in the sense of, you quite often get people get demonized on the mainstream media, and it's not until you actually sit down. I mean, for example, Graham McCready is a classic example. The way that the New Zealand media portray Graham McCready is they make him sound like he's a silly old man that's wasting the court's time.
Oh, he's a serial litigant.
He's a serial litigant. How dare he actually use the law to his advantage, you know? Only we're allowed to do that. But, you know, we saw him carrying the prosecution on John Banks in the High Court for electoral fraud. Now, I've covered lots of trials before, and he's an excellent presenter of his legal argument, and he's brilliant. And then the second aspect of it was, you know, what he did afterwards, we turned around, he came out of the trial, and you and I were the only people that actually went and interviewed him, like, in depth. So this guy had just turned around. He just made an illegal precedent. He'd taken down a private prosecution of a former mayor, former minister of government, huge ramifications. He had private prosecutions against the prime minister of the country pending. So when he comes out of the court, what does Mike Sabin, the son of Brooke Sabin, Brooke Sabin, the son of Mike Sabin, the MP that's just been stood, basically lost his seat because he's facing criminal charges, say? He's like, "Oh, I see you got a new suit today." And that was the extent of the media's in-depth questioning of this incredibly amazing guy. And we sat down and we spoke to him. And I think it's on your channel somewhere. We spoke to him for about an hour, and you did most
about
of the 20, questions.
About 23 minutes, I think, is the video there. And also chasing John Banks down the road with the megaphone.
I'm right about that too. That was funny. I didn't do that because that's funny. I don't chase. I'm not a media. But
hey, somebody's got to do it, you know.
Yeah, oh no, I love that you did. I think that was great. But, you know, of course, that didn't get shown on the mainstream news. But the point is that, you know, Graham McGreevy, we sat down for 20 minutes, and along that way, he never deviated from the legal case. He presented his case he would only talk about the facts. He wouldn't talk about the theory. That guy should have been on the network news, on the news current affairs, late night current affairs show that night, talking about what was actually going on, talking about the private having just actually won a private prosecution, talking about the prosecutions he had against the Prime Minister. Nobody gave him a 1 minute's worth of time. And then, of course, what happened was that that case later got thrown out, not because of any fault of Graham McCready, but because the police, and I've got some serious questions, I think that was a setup too, they mishandled it. So even though Graham McCready's argument was correct, John Banks walks out. And now it's like everyone's like, "Oh, Graham McCready is just a fool. You know, he didn't even win that case." He did win it. It was actually the system that set him up. And that's the frustrating thing, is that our media,
they're destroying people's lives. They're destroying the country.
They're cowards.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in the case of the private prosecution, I don't know all the details, but in one of them, you know, it was the case involving Russell Malcolm, who is another person you've had on your show. Now, I spent two nights with Russell, and he took me through all the court documents. And, you know, and I had a lot of problems with Russell because he's a very strong-willed guy. And I was basically saying, you know, I agree with a lot of the things he's saying, Russell, but it's not about whether I believe you. It's about what can you prove. And one of the things, you know, he was saying, you know, the Prime Minister personally set his bail conditions for basically saying a few nasty, naughty things on a blog, which, you know, none of us we've all said at a pub some stage or other. Now, you couldn't actually directly prove that the Prime Minister did do this, but the court records say this case is being monitored by the highest levels of government. And this is for someone writing, you know, bloody politicians. You know, that deserves to be. And yet nobody, not one person in the mainstream media, bothered to look at any of the actual material that Graham McCready had gathered on his prosecutions.
And it was because of Russell Malcolm's research in this 56-page dossier. It took quite a while because I wasn't prepared to read it. But what I was prepared to do is get Russell round to my house, have a few beers, sit him in front of a camera with a microphone for a number of hours, and read out this entire thing, and then spend three nights consecutively editing that so his entire story would be up online for people to see. And we also spent a bit of time just sort of summarizing the small points and facts about it for those who didn't want to spend three hours watching
it. And, so, you know, again, the interesting thing about Russell Malcolm was that, you know, when you listen, when you sit down and you listen to him, first of all, you know, some of the things he's saying are, you know, I've been in the media for 25 years and I'm aware of government corruption, but some of the things he's saying were just like so out there. I was going, "No way is this happening. This is just too much." Like, you know, and I looked at the documentation, and because of that reservation, you know, I thought, "No, this can't." I was only sticking with what I can actually prove. Yet the events which we're now seeing that are surrounding and linked into the by-election of the Northland with Winston Peters and Mike Sabin are now starting to show us, even the mainstream media is starting to click on this fact, how corrupt the Henderson police forces and how corrupt council government is in that area. And it's like something out of the Wild Wild West. And it's, I mean, you know, and even like, you know, it was interesting because, you know, Malcolm was giving me all the sort of information about corrupt MPs, and I started going, no way, this doesn't happen in New Zealand. And I went away and I did, went on to my trip, and then I started to come back as I started to go and head into Rodney. I saw in the windows of different shops, I saw these posters promoting a fun day, come and check out the motorbikes and all would be great, except for every single poster, it was embossed with the logo of the Headhunters motorcycle gang. And so you were seeing that this hugely, like probably one of the number one organized crime groups in New Zealand, and like, you know, they're not unknown or unfamous, was having their logos all over the place, and they've become so institutionalized that they've become normalized and actually recognized as being part of the system. And then, you know, you start to sort of see things in the newspaper where people like, they have, you know, fight club nights where they have these big boxing matches and TV3 turn up, and it becomes like a list of A's of all the celebrities who want to be part of it. And you start to realize, think, hey, man, there's something not quite going on here. And slowly, bit by bit, by not just walking away and not being afraid and putting those stories in and pushing them, people like Malcolm, people like you and people like me have actually slowly managing to get that information out to the mainstream media, and people suddenly realize that, you know what, there's something not right in New Zealand, there's something seriously rotten, and we need to stop and sort it out.
Well, we had in fact, there's another one of the videos that I've done. Let me just, how many have I done? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. I've made 17 videos in the last 24 hours. A lot of them are protest speeches from the TPPA and also the Rates Revolt rally. Now, furthermore to Russell Malcolm, one of the other great resistors and exposers of scumbaggery in this country along the local council vein is a man named Bruce Rogan from the Mangawhai Ratepayers and Residents Association. Yeah. The list of quotes that he gives in his speech to the Auckland Rates Revolt crowd from all the authorities that he went to for help about the unlawful rates and everything that they had to pay trying to take people's houses, and it's the Green Party, the Labour Party, the National Party, the Ombudsman, the everything. But one thing that was most particularly interesting was a former Scotland Yard detective who got assigned to the case who said to him privately, "I've lived in a lot of countries, and New Zealand is the most corrupt by far."
And soon after,
he was released from the investigation.
the funny thing is, you should say about that, because there's actually a guy down here that I know who's he's straight out of a Morse Inspector Morse novel, and he's kind of the guy that when I really got information, I think, well, maybe I need to go and check this out. I always go to him because he then rips me to shred in about 15 seconds. Brilliant mind, and he said the same situation. Came over to New Zealand as a wave of police officers from the UK came in the 70s. He lasted about 3 years because he was just so, and this was 1970s, he was so disgusted at the level of institutionalized corruption in New Zealand that he couldn't handle it. And Peter Williams, in his book Stoned on Duty, says exactly the same thing. He says, "We refuse to acknowledge that corruption existed in New Zealand's police force, and therefore, by refusing to look for it, it prospered." And we're now getting to the point where we're starting to realize this situation, and we doesn't matter whether you're down in Dunedin and we've got the Bandidos, or up in north, and you got, you know, in fact, they are everywhere, the Headhunters. We're starting to see this, people realizing that these aren't just, you know, a few guys messing around the weekend, that these are huge criminal organizations that have got their fingers in police, customs, every single government agent you care to name. They're now starting to buy their own political MPs. A lot of that stuff happened in Northern. You'll find there's, you know, a lot of the action in Northern always came back to the Sky City Casino, and that's what I always like to think of national headquarters as, you know, de facto headquarters in Auckland. And you find that a lot of this, the dodgy guys that were dealing in kauri trees, that they were trading for pea, had very close affiliations with very household national names that we all recognise that the title of national. You know, so we're starting to realise that, you know, this little image that we have in New Zealand is not corrupt, and that we're all, you know, such, it's all so wholesome and it's like Hobbiton and nothing bad ever happens here. It's just not true. And this is why it's really important for us to actually be out there on the streets with the TPPA or anything else, making sure that we're actually being active citizens. This is what my grandfather, Major Robertson Cox, did. This is what his generation did. My parents' generation didn't do it, and we're having to relearn that step all again. You want a good country, you've got to work for it.
I was thinking we need a new tourism campaign. Instead of 100% pure New Zealand, it would just be 100% pure scumbaggery, and it should be closer to the truth.
I, I think it is clean green New Zealand. It's green for the slime that oozes out from the halls of power.
Well, you know, what happens to a stagnant pond? Where does the scum go? It goes to the top, doesn't it?
It does indeed.
And it chokes out all the life of everything that lives beneath the waters, and it is all of us, and it's our passive acceptance of it that has allowed it to grow. And I've got a quote from Robbie Kaiviti, the founder of the New Zealand People's Mandate Party. One should not support any evil, whether the greater or the lesser. Any support of corruption encourages it.
Yeah, that is an interesting one. You know, again, I go back to Winston Peters, and I've been thinking about him recently because I've been looking at some of the books that I wrote, State Secrets 1 and State Secrets 2, and looking at things to do with the Wine Box Inquiry. And, you know, I find myself, the problem with Winston at the moment, this is New Zealand, we've got Labour, National, Green Party, and Winston First, and Winston is the lesser of weevils. But, you know, I find myself looking at things like the Glen Owen affair. I find myself looking at things when he was doing the inquiry into whether or not there's corruption in the New Zealand fishery industry, and he employed Ross Morant, the wonderfully notorious bent Ross Morant, to investigate for him, while Ross Morant was in actual fact working out of the offices of Vela Fisheries, which is one of the companies in questions. I find myself looking at things that Winston Peters said during the Winebox inquiry to deal with the recovery of Paul White discs, where Winston gave very detailed description of those discs, but then claimed that he had never seen them, which is kind of an oxymoron. If you haven't seen them, then how do you know what they look like? You know, so I'm thinking back to the Murray Loans affair, where that and several other cases, we're seeing Winston actually has quite close contacts within the Central Intelligence Agency, and I find myself going, you know, we need to make sure we don't glamorize. We're fed up with Labour, we're fed up with Greens, we're fed up with the National Party. We need to make sure that we don't make Winston into something more than he is, because Winston is not squeaky clean, and that's the thing. We just turn around and we've got, oh, well, you know, we've got to have a winner. Let's make, you know, Winston the winner. And no, you can't criticize him ever. Then we're just going to repeat the same mistake all over again.
I'll criticise whoever does something wrong, you know, and yeah. that's
well, he's ultimate. He's done plenty of wrong, you know. I mean, during the New Zealand, United Nations Food for Oil program, Winston turned around and came out when there was, you know, revealed that New Zealand companies were involved in this food for oil, what the Australians call weapons for weed affair, which is basically what I'd been writing about in my first book, State Secrets, before we'd even heard about food for oil. And he said, oh, no, we looked into that and we're clean. So Transparency International, I'm not talking about the New Zealand Transparency International because those guys are a joke, but the actual Transparency International guys who happen to be in the country looked at it and went, you guys haven't even investigated the primary documents. You know, how can you say you've investigated when you haven't even looked at the primary documents? So they did it again. And Winston Peters then came out and said, well, you know, the New Zealand police and the Serious Fraud Office have looked into it and there's no wrongdoing. Well, I investigated that subject and I spoke to every single one of those companies, bar Fonterra, because they wouldn't reply to my calls, asking them, you know, about their connection to the UN Food for Oil scandal. And what I discovered was that neither the police or the Serious Fraud Office had been anywhere near them. So Winston told an outright lie when he said that there'd been an investigation. There never was.
So, yeah, and that's the thing. I've tried looking into, because I had the exact same suspicion as you do. Oh, this he's great. He's got all this kind of thing. And I'm just like, you know, there has to be something else here. I want to see a track record of lies. I want to see the track record of scumbaggery. I want to see a track record of disenfranchised people.
You'll find it if you look at Winston and you look up for the fisheries industry, with Telovich Fisheries, you look at the Racing Association, you'll find it there. You know, it's even interesting. I mean, and look, I'm trying not to be, because, you know, there's life is not black and white. One of the guys that Winston has with him is Ron Mark, who formerly served with the New Zealand SAS. And Rod Mark's Facebook page is absolutely fascinating, because the people that are on that, I know a lot by name, and so I pay attention to it. Ron is a good, as far as any politician goes, he's a good politician, and he's also very astute. He's not stupid, but at the same time, you know, he has that slight bias and a slightly pro-ish US view. And I'm not saying anti-American, but there is a slight blinkering, and you do have to be aware, and it's up for people like me not to just turn around and join the Winston Peters fan club and go, oh, Winston, you're lovely. He's better than the rest, but there's still a lot of scumbaggery there.
Well, that's because we're not idiots, you know. Who in the hell has ever blindly trusted and said, oh, there's nothing about them I don't like. I mean, bro, there's stuff about me that I don't even like.
Oh, me is guilty as charged. But I just make that point because, you know, when I look at the Northland section, for example, you know, a lot of what Winston says is pretty correct in terms of anti-corruption issues and the job creations. But at the same time, you know, what loses out under Winston is the environment up in Northland. Like there's, I doubt there's going to be any protections for the fisheries up there. I doubt that we're going to see a reduction on the curry tree black market or the importation of curry to offshore. You know, there's a lot of things. The environment at the end of the day is the one that doesn't actually win under Winston.
Well, there's also the other elements of the equation. I mean, let's go across from the bad things. Let's think about, we've talked about all those good things as well in the last hour. And that's what you call fair and balanced journalism, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, are we going to talk this guy up and never criticize him? No, we're not. You know why? Because we're not liars who are trying to misinform you, and we're not idiots who love being wrong.
And that's the thing, unfortunately, again, which is absence from our media, is that we have a sort of situation in our mainstream media where you have a person or a team that you back, like a sports team, and you never bag those guys, especially because they're the ones clicking your tickets. They're the ones that make sure you get into junkets and give you free hotels, and you know they'll help your career if you help them. But then you have the other side, which you always go after. Now, what we don't see in media anymore is the situation where people go in and say, wait a minute, you know, I'm not here to be your friend. I'm here to actually report on actually what's going on. And when you've done things which are positive, and Winston Peters has done plenty of positive stuff as a politician, you know, he's delivered the goods time and time again.
Yeah. Probably more than any other one I know of.
Winston knows how the game's played, and he plays it very seriously.
Yeah, and I found that as well. I tried to corner him, and I tried to do the same thing with Nikki Hager and a number of other people. I tried to ask them if there was some kind of global governance system being set up, as the conspiracy theories say, like some kind of New World Order, and you had the evidence to prove that it was absolutely true. Would you come out and say that, knowing that you would be ridiculed for it, or not?
Yeah, and that's, I mean, no politician will ever turn around and do anything they can use to be nailed with. The situation with Nikki is also interesting because...
unfortunately, we don't have time to go into it just now because there's the music.
I'll just say it's complicated.
That's right. Ladies and gentlemen, Ben Vigen. And I think that you want to be Googling Postman Productions and Ben Vigen, V-I-D-G-E-N, pronounced like a pigeon. Thank you very much for coming on
today.
Take
your flag with you to the next rally.
Yeah, indeed. Take your New Zealand flag.
Wave it proud.
Yeah, indeed you do. Wave it proud, be loud, and don't step down, you know? Step up to the plate.
We're surrounded, Lieutenant. We're meant to be. We're paratroopers.
We'll see you again sometime.